I swing between being extremely positive and confident to being absolutely in despair about things, but to be honest. But I think with numbers, with people around you, I don't know if I could have done it by myself. I mean, definitely not having six people and each one making up for the other when one was lacking in that belief. That's how we got there, really. Just rolling it over and rolling it over. And it's funny because when success sort of comes, you go, yep, okay. You don't sort of jump around, yay! I mean, of course, it's exciting, but it just was there, It didn't just happen in one single. We didn't just have a hit out of a garage, We just kept on playing and playing, and that's the way we work, that's how we function. We're a real living band. It was incredible in America. I mean, we really felt like you suddenly get this feeling that, oh, people know who you are and you really exist in their lives, in their minds, and they really are enjoying you and they're enjoying your music, and it's a great feeling, and it really urges you on, It's I think it's the majority of the there's the pros and cons. It's definitely one of the pros of it, Let's face it, people in this sort of position tend to be very insecure, because they don't have to be, they're insecure about bigger things than most people deal with, So you have to have a lot of strength, a lot of support. There was a pressure, but we were attempting to do whatever we wanted to do. I remember these meetings where we'd say, well, what do we do? Do we start, being really conscious and really thinking about what music people are going to like? I mean, do we end up in that sort of barrel, which is something that we really don't, we're not interested in at all, really? Or do we just have the conviction just to make the album? That was the pressure, to make the album that we really wanted to make. And that's the pressure, really. It's not what you think it is. It's more like, can we just stick to ourselves and stick to what we want to do, Andrew's a bit of a rock star, actually. He was the lead singer and everything. And I don't know what happened. I think they were trying out drummers, and Andrew did say, you should be a singer. Nah, I don't do that, I was in a motorcycles and things like that. I was a real boy. And he gave me a microphone, and I started singing in a garage. I am pretty nomadic. I like it. I really don't feel comfortable in one place for too long. I really like to move around. What do they say? It's the travelling, not arriving. I'm like that. It's a big world. I mean, and I'm very, very lucky to be able to go and see it. That's one of my greatest pleasures. We've never really gone backwards in excess. And I mean, it's just nice to keep moving forward bit by bit. And Kick did more so than that, when we were really surprised. It was a very happy surprise. I mean, Need You Tonight, for instance, was a song that was the last song we ever thought of putting out as a single. And then we decided to, because we really liked the song, and boy, it was a shock. It restored my faith in radio anyway.
Michael was always interested in literature. He was a poet. He liked writing stories.
He was a poet.
I think he thought of himself more like that then he was a singer.
Yeah.
It was sort of annoying to him sometimes to be a singer,
Yeah.
And I think he likes to think of himself in that bohemian sense as a
Jack
person.
Kerouac,
he kind of lived that idea, But the point I was trying to make as well is I think with his lyrics, I think he really wanted to zone in on trying to perfect like a haiku, like Japanese poetry, saying a lot with very little words. He was really, really good at that minimalist sort of idea. But I think also, I mean, I wrote lyrics, but I didn't play games with him to get my lyrics instead of his lyrics and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
I also felt because he had to go on stage and sing it.
And have a passion for it.
He wanted to own the lyric.
Yeah.
And that's exactly right. Made his performance on stage even more dynamic.
He definitely had a way of living because he worked his entire work experience of his entire life was 2 days because I got him a job at a streetlight factory in Brookvale when we got back from Perth, and I was working down there and he needed some money, so I got him a job there, and he lasted two. I picked him up, made him breakfast, got him in the car, and
I'm surprised he lasted one day.
But the third day I went to pick him up, opened the door, and it's like he's just I'm done. That was it. Two days.
What's ironic about that that story though with Michael is that he would work 24/7. All year, if he was driven to do something,
If he's passionate,
and we all did the same thing, And so, but he, but I don't think he was destined in that sense to live a normal life.
Yeah. No. Well, he didn't. I mean, more than any of us, he had a pretty, interesting upbringing because they were residents of Hong Kong for about 10 years, so. Yeah. he grew up with, you know, an au pair and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And just that high Hong Kong lifestyle, you know, the expats, you know, going to the expat school in Hong Kong and all that sort of stuff.
And then North Hollywood
and
High.
And then later on, North Hollywood High.
Which I drove past all the time.
Yeah. So he kind of had a worldly outlook, you know, right from the get-go.
I think what's significant about that too, what Kirk's saying about the, you know, Michael going to school in the United States, is that when we turned up there and we'd do media and we were talking to Americans, Michael would look and go, yeah, so what? Because he'd been living there, you see.
Yeah.
And for a lot of Aussies that get off, you know, Spaceship Australia and turn into these other countries.
Especially at that period.
You know, they get nervous and anxious because they don't understand the culture.
What a rock star. And we've spoken before about how he was a rock star in the truest sense of the word. Mm. And you guys were fine with that because he had his house in the south of France and he was mates with Bono and things like that, you know.
Yeah. He sort of took the heat. The media heat from us. But, I mean, you know, it didn't start out that way. I mean, you're not born a rock star. None of us were, you know. Michael was actually quite shy, you know, in essence.
I mean, we grew up together. Mm. When he started singing with us, he wasn't really a singer. He was more of a poet. And he was in a band with Andrew and Gary. Kirk and I were in a different band and John was in another band playing nudist colonies or something.
You'll never live that down.
John's like, yeah, thanks, Tim. Yeah. It's okay. Great.
It's okay because they're here now. Come on in.
And but, you know, we watched him grow and turn into this fantastic performer and singer, and his voice just improved, you know, incredibly right in front of us. I mean, we all did as musicians.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We did everything together, lived it, you know, out of each other's pockets and spent 20 years slogging it out together. So, you know.
I think Michael's definitely a very charismatic person, as an entertainer, but also as a person.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if you've ever met him. He's quite funny.
Yes, I think 23 at the time. And,
but he's quite funny, very well-read, literate, you know, witty at times.
And very personable too.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And a good guy to be around. And for me personally, these guys probably feel the same way. I get a little bit over the idea that it's all about the end of his life, for there was so much of his life was very positive and
all of it
and proactive, as a person.
Mm.
With Michael, you know, he would be like meeting his heroes like Andy Warhol at In Excess parties and stuff like that.
Yeah, so, that was weird.
Yeah. So Michael was really just really the guy next door. He was our brother and friend, but he was also secret rock star.
Actually, just a quick little story, as that Kirk and myself and Michael were sent off, you know, with our packed lunches over to go to Los Angeles, New York and London to go on a writing and, you know, sort of a cultural experience.
This is before we recorded Shabu Shabu.
That's true. Yeah. And anyway, and then, but we, when we got to the US, you know, I remember we took, the one thing which we'd recorded and hadn't been released yet and played it to Bob Claremountain. Producer engineer, you know, done massive records for people like Bruce Springsteen, the Stones, and I think Michael Jackson, I don't know who else, a massive resume.
Yeah.
And he said, just put it out. I love this. It's fantastic. Then we went to London and I think it was Hugh Padgham. We went and we actually went into.
He was a big producer at the time.
Yeah, Police producer.
Yeah. We went into the Police's recording studio session.
Police station.
With their gear, actually. Sitting around the room.
Yeah.
You know, there's Sting's bass and there was Stewart's drum kit. And I was like, wow, to me, because, you know, we weren't at that level, at that point. And I thought that was really exciting.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, and because we are fans of people as much as we have our own fans as a group.
Yeah.
And Matt, some people may not realize it works like that. Michael was fans of other artists. He loved, for example, the Bee Gees is one of his favorite bands.
Okay.
Anyone else remember something like that?
Yeah, Motown was a big influence.
And Nick Cave, I think, was,
absolutely.
Michael loved that sort of not commercial. In fact, all the music we listened to growing up and as a band, none of it was pop. It was all kind of a lot of the stuff we listened to when we were, formulating our style as a band was real muso stuff, like Weather Report Steely Dan.
Yeah.
Talking Heads.
It's amazing how it all comes full circle because, we're all into Queen because obviously they're an amazing band, and then turns out that we're doing gigs with Queen, and there's Freddie Mercury and there's Michael and Freddie Mercury and everyone hanging out.
We became mates.